it.
If more people played tabletop RPGs, it would be... I'd love to believe it would be a much nicer world, but I don't necessarily know that. I mean, again, I started playing this game in the 80s, and I mean, you know the rules about girls playing back then. It sucked for us.
I'm choking back all the flippant, rude answers that...
You can... I will just edit it out so it sounds like you agree with everything I say.
Well, here's the thing, Devin. My gaming group was half girls from the beginning. And they ruled the roost. They told us what to do because we were dummies. These guys were dummies. Right. And they let us know that in no uncertain terms. And being as they were all wives or lovers or girlfriends... and we all wanted to get into their pants and stay there, we listened. They held the whip hand, so to speak. I understand it was very different for a lot of gamers, but no, and the games I played in, the gals got listened to.
Oh, yeah, but the problem is that you had to be dating somebody in your group, and... that just causes its own fucking problems.
Fucking problems.
Yeah, no. I mean, wrong kind of fucking problems, but yeah, still fucking problems.
Yeah.
I love this story. I had somebody so obsessed with trying to take care of me or my character, because I don't think that he could differentiate us from each other, that he TPK'd our party. Yeah. Wait, I had a rogue. We were going down through a dungeon. There was a corridor. I went down the corridor, checked for traps, everything else as I was going, and I somehow missed them but didn't set any off because I wasn't in proximity of them. But I don't know that. And I get all the way to the end of the corridor and I can hear the bad guys in the next room. And this asshole decided to metagame, decided somehow his character knew, despite the fact that I hadn't engaged in them, there was no initiative rolled or anything else. It was just me listening. I could have gone back, but no, he decided to run down the corridor, and because he thought that I got all the traps, that it was fine, and ran down the corridor, set them off, closed off the end of the corridor where the rest of our party was, and set them in an acid bath, and closed off the end of the corridor I was at, so I got to slide underneath and get discovered, unfortunately, in my effort not to be closed into a fucking corridor. And so he got killed, the rest of my party got killed, and I somehow managed to get out of that, and I was the last person alive. He was never allowed at our table again, but he was so obsessed with believing that my character couldn't possibly do anything, I guess. I don't know. I mean, yeah. So, but this was actually something that would happen a lot at the gaming table, where you would have, you would have guys trying to romance your character. So I started making male characters and then occasionally remind them, like, you're talking to a dude, by the way.
Oh.
You're trying to romance a dude. And, you know, I mean, great if you are and your character's that way, but I just want to remind you, like, my character is a dude.
And
but
I didn't have any of this stuff because I was raised by strong women, you know, who were much older than me and in my family, you know. So, and growing up in Don Mills, all the men got into limos or fast cars and took off downtown to work in office towers all day. So I grew up with all the women. Who, you know, and they were rich bitches, meaning they did what they wanted to do. They had the money and the forceful personalities. So I just assume women ran everything. that was my thing growing up. And when they did it at the gaming table, okay. That was the norm for me. So, and I hear tales like this and I say, oh my God, how did you deal with that? Holy crap. Because you...
Oh, I became an asshole.
Yeah, but...
I was mean.
But all of this is so foreign to me. This wasn't the experience I had in growing up. But I believe it because I hear it over and over again. And I think, were you trying to drive your girlfriends and friends and lovers and wives out of the hobby? Jesus.
My first introduction to D&D was absolutely perfect. Like, it was wonderful. I was 14, over a friend's house. And there was a group of adults, both male and female, playing the game and having a blast. And it never dawned on me when we first started playing, because I was playing with my friend and their father was the DM, never dawned on me that this wouldn't always be the experience at the table. And it wasn't until I started going to gaming cons or I started going to game stores to, you know, play with strangers and stuff, that this would be a norm. And I was like, wow, we're not playing the same game at all. Like, this isn't... why would this be appealing in any way? And I would constantly get from a lot of the male players that, you know, oh, this just proves that you're too weak to play the game. You don't have the stamina to play it. You mean because I don't want you to sexually harass my character to the point where she wants to cleave your head off of your shoulders? Like, she doesn't want to do the enemy's bidding just because you're that big of an asshole? I understand. How does this make me weak for the game? All this does is make me want to go find a table that works better. And that's actually how I became a DM, and that's how I ended up with the group I'm in. Because, you know, you for a community that is a bunch of outsiders in society, man, do they love those moments where they feel that they can lord over somebody else.
Yeah.
And when you're blind, this is something constantly we heard. Oh, you can't play. You can't play because you're blind. You can't see your dice. You can't see, you know, you can't read the book. We don't have anything. We can't pause the game to accommodate you. You know what? Fine. I'll make my own fucking table. Mm-hmm. So I now have 4 blind players that play, and I also have deaf players that we've now... So it's a core group of like 8 of us, and then my deaf players are currently in their own campaign, sister campaign. Because we made our own tables.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah, if I can also share, the first gaming group I was in had two... We were in high school, so 2 girls at that time. And they lasted 1 session, as they were alienated by the GM. Mm-hmm. Who essentially alienated everyone else at the table anyway. And also stole our stuff and other... Yeah. It was a fun group that I was happy to never play with again.
Yeah.
But yeah, it essentially, same here, made me want to be a GM, because I was like, I did not enjoy that experience, so let me make sure that my friend's group and I never have to run into that issue again.
Yeah.
And now, years later, I bemoan the fact that I'm never a player.
I actually don't want to be. Like, I love playing every once in a while, but I the only reason I don't want to DM for other groups is because I do have a playstyle. Like I said, I've been playing with them for 20 years, and I always worry that I'm not going to make as good of an experience for like a normal sighted person, because we play with such unusual rules at times, because we ignore any sight rules, obviously. But also the way that we describe things or that we navigate the world is quite different. And having had normal sighted players at my table get very frustrated, because either they think that I'm like waxing prose in my description, because wow, it seems like really flowery, and I'm like, it's just not describing it like how you're visually seeing it. It's not poetic. Or just getting frustrated over them believing that, you know, applying sight rules to things, or, you know, like it's very different. Simon knows, because Simon has had me as a player, and I will ask questions at a...
And as a GM for one session.
Well, it would have been longer. We're gonna do it, goddammit. Because, you know... Well, because I don't want to forever be a GM to only blind people. I would love to be able to have more experience with sighted players, so it's not so awkward and I don't feel like I'm ruining their experience.
But that brings an interesting point that I would like to ask a question to Ed about. Because playing for your group, Devin, you had to change certain rules and all that. I'm going to ask, Ed, do you have any house rules that you use in the game that... Let's take the game that has been running for... with your home group, even though you meet, like, once every...
The unofficial rules that we use at the table during conventions and so on is don't split up the party, because you almost certainly die. You know? And we just sort of... Right. That's a DM's convenience rule. So that people don't sit there idle for 15, 20 minutes. Somebody else tries to do something really complex that they shouldn't and gets all the playing time. But the only thing from the Home Realms campaign that we have as a house rule is what comes out of your mouth comes out of your character's mouth. So no standing 5 feet away from the orc discussing how you're going to take the orc down without the orc hearing you. The other unspoken rule, but everybody knows it, is we're here to role play. So don't just say, well, I've got a greater charisma than the guard, so I talk my way past him. No, role play it. That's what we're here for. We're here for the ham acting. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do Monty Python voices if that makes you uncomfortable to do them, but we're here for the acting experience, so don't ever tell me, oh, we just kill them and move on. No. Do it. Do it in front of me. Give us the play experience. Role play it. And most Home Realms game sessions, weapons may never be drawn, or they're half drawn as a threat. Don't make me pull this out of the scabbard, because I might use it. Because they're all intrigue. They're all palace intrigue and getting off in dark corners and saying, have you noticed that the Lady Rosanthe has been seen a lot in the gardens recently? Just a comment. And then they move on, having planted the seed. Somebody go, she has? What's going on? I better go and spy on her myself, sort of thing. So that's what most play sessions are. They're, and which is why I cannot reproduce the Home Realms campaign for outsiders. They can sit down at the table and experience it, because it's like 60 or 70 subplots overlapping and on top of each other all the time. That's what play in the Home Realms is.
Yeah.
And we don't care about level advancement. After all these years, the average party level is 9th. We just don't care. That's not what we're there for. We're there for the deep and abiding friendships and I'm not talking now about the players. I'm talking about their characters and they're building relationships with people in the community who are the people in your neighborhood. You know, it's like an American sitcom that took place on low budget. So essentially one set. So MASH or All in the Family back in the day, where they were basically, it's one room. And so there's a stable of recurring characters that pop in and out of every episode, and it's how you interact with them. Well, all of the Knights of Mithranor have day jobs in the real world. They have to make rent or buy groceries. So and they have investments. And they're safeguarding those investments. Mm-hmm. They now have a vested interest in law and order within a certain area where their investments are. So they're trying to protect a country without horning in on its proper or its official protectors, who are totally inadequate to the threats at hand, so they have to step in all the time, but they have to step in without seeming to step on the toes of the local Leos, the local law enforcement officers. So it's all that sort of stuff and the dance that goes on, and it's real life, and I'm portraying the news rumors and gossip that is reaching their ears. With every caravan that stops at the inn at night, that's how the caravan people get free drinks. They share the latest news, some of which they may be making up because they have nothing interesting to peddle, but most of which is the news and rumors of the wider world that's happening. So I'm portraying the entire setting, and that's a Home Realms game. That's what it is. And so that's what we do most play sessions. We are doing an episode in the life of, the next episode in the life of. There's very little dungeon delving and grabbing treasure and killing monsters. There was a lot more of it when they started, because that's what they were interested in, having read the fledgling D&D publications at the time. Oh, we'll go down a dungeon, we'll kill monsters and take their treasure. My interest in the realms from the beginning was storytelling. That's what I was using it for before there was D&D. And as all of my players went on for years, they became more and more interested in the unfolding story that they were telling together. We are all telling by putting it together, and less and less interested in monsters and treasure and level advancement and all this stuff. And of course, as the game system editions have gone on, and there's more and more what we used to call, us old guys used to call, min-maxing, you know, building a mightier character build so that your character can do anything, no matter what its class, it can stand alone and doesn't need to work in a team, or as much as possible doesn't have to work in a team, because you can do everything. They are not interested in that at all. It's like, no, the whole point of this is to work as a team and to get along. It's the old socializing thing that you get shoved through on school, public school, for, as opposed to a private school where you are with your own class and with your own backgrounds. It's the socializing of, you have to learn to get along with everybody on this planet because we only have the one planet. So you got to work together to do things. Nobody can accomplish everything alone. You just don't have the power. So you have to work with everybody. So it's all that being over and over again drummed through. And then they get really proud of their achievements, which is why, you know, you will hear at conventions, oh, let me tell you about when my party killed Asmodeus. And you roll your eyes because you weren't there. So you don't share those memories. They are really important memories to the people who were, because hopefully not have to fight in a real war. Hopefully they will not have to watch their buddies die horribly around them. Hopefully it can all be a dream, or, you know, fantasy. So these are how they're building memories of when they did something important, and they made the right moral choice. They saved their friends or the community or whatever, because they did the right thing. And it matters intensely to them that they did that, because in real life, most of us don't get to be heroes, and we would be lousy at it if we tried under pressure. You know, we might do okay, but that would just be the luck of the draw, because we're caught in the heat of the moment and we're desperately trying to make the best of it. And we may and we may not. But I mean, it matters intensely to played in a long-running role-playing campaign what they've achieved and what they've done. And it just doesn't, if you weren't part of that, if you weren't sitting at the table, you can appreciate how deep what it means to them, but you can't feel it because you weren't there. It's not your memories, which is something I've seen in real life, because I'm just old enough to remember the last few World War I vets before they died, and then hear all the stories of the Depression and living through it, and hear all the stories from the Second World War vets. And there's that up in Canada, hockey is the game, or and increasing, or really was when I was young. And Mm-hmm. There's this old saw about when was the golden age of hockey? The answer is when you were 12.
I had never heard that, but yep, it makes a lot of sense.
Yep, it's when you were 12, and it resonates to everybody. And so when you hear people tell war stories, and the war stories, they aren't just men, it's all the women served in their own way. We had a woman in this village who was 4 foot nothing before she died. I mean, sure, I'm sure she'd curled up quite a bit during her life. And as a young girl, she flew bombers across the Atlantic, brand new ones, to England to as they were built, so they could be chewed up in the meat grinder. And then she would fly another one. And she sat on phone books to do it, to be able to reach the pedals. And and she flabbergasted a lot of the upper class twit CEOs at the bases she landed at, because they'd step on board to, you know, and where's the crew, you know, and she'd say, it's me.
Yep.
Oh, nonsense, you can't possibly float across the Atlantic, little girl. That was her war. So you feel it in the emotion in their voices, not just because it was an important time and they were doing important things, and so many of their buddies didn't make it, so there's all the emotions wrapped up in this. It's also, that's when they were young and the world was their oyster, and it's when they did things that mattered to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that now. They are trying to recapture that moment in youth when, you know, the world was, you know, not better, because it was worse. It was hell. It's when they were important and what they did mattered. And they were leaving their mark on the world. And of course, that's what we're role-playing when we role-play adventurers who can leave their mark on the world, who can save the kingdom, who can come to the rescue of the common people who are oppressed by whatever the monster is. It's when we can do things that matter. And I think that's why role-playing matters so intensely, particularly to people who aren't the best and prettiest in society, who for whatever reason are outcast or marginalized or feel pushed aside. And boy, this sounds like I'm giving a sermon, doesn't it?
No.
But yeah, it's those. I think that's what makes role playing special. What makes it different from so many other games? Because so many other games we play, it may be a great time for the family to get together, and there may be family traditions, like, you know, Uncle Frank will always win, some way. Yeah, or whatever. But if we're playing Parcheesi or Euchre or Monopoly, the rules, aside from whatever house rules we develop around the table, the rules don't change. They're the same for everybody. But in role playing, you're always making up the stories you go along.
The thing that's interesting about this is, I don't know if you've read, there was a study that was made years ago, basically that the memories you form playing role-playing games occupy the same space in your brain as actual memories.
Yes. Yeah.
And it becomes, like you said, you know, if you play any other type of game, or even if you watch a piece of media, the fact that you're more or less passively consuming the media doesn't occupy the same space in your brain and the same importance, if you would. Wow, my French came out for a second. The same importance as, you know, we have killed Asmodeus.
Yeah.
We've killed Asmodeus. We know it's a game. We know we're talking about pretend. You know, someone might have flicked Asmodeus's mini off the table if, you know, they wanted to break their pewter minis way back when, or break their plastic minis nowadays. But in your mind, the fight that happened, it's as if it had happened. Like, those events did happen, and that one NPC who sacrificed themselves, it almost tricked the brain into thinking, like, you've lost a friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that community you build in your home game over years and years, these NPCs, even though they're figments, they become as important to the players as an actual person that they would have met one day and cared for.
Yes.
And that's it. It's what makes role-playing games so important in my mind.
We live and are part of a special hobby. And I know everybody says that, whether they, you know, whether it's model railroading or competitive gardening or whatever, you know. But yeah, role-playing is different in that one way. And it leaves its mark on us all.
I mean, it's a very emotional hobby. It's a very emotional community.
Oh, yeah.
An emotional industry, because not only are we can use this whole thing, this podcast is a great example. You know, when I first got to talk to you, Ed, like, I just kept referring to you as God, because as, you know, someone who played in Faerun, you created it, your God to Faerun. Like, there's a lot of people in this hobby that feel the same way. So I kept joking, I talked to God today. Later today, I'll tell everyone I interviewed God, like, you know. But that's how it is.
Every responsibility time.
Yeah. All right. I mean, come on now. But I mean, like, it is, though, because it becomes so much of not only the worlds that we're playing in and the memories that we build, but, you know, we get to be our most vulnerable at the table with our fellow players, with our DM. We get to romance. We get to fall in love with more than just another character, or, you know, we're no longer passively reading something, we're actively experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so even when we're not technically playing the game, but we're talking about, you know, new modules that come out or new shows or new settings or whatever, I'm never ever surprised when people get really passionate about something that, you know, was already written in a book and now somebody's changing it, or, you know, they're upset that they've nerfed something about one of the classes, or, you know, because we all these help make the memories that we have.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, if somebody changes something, you're treading on my memories. You're treading right on my, yeah.
But here's the thing, I'm going to say this a bazillion times if I have to. Hey, listen. Just because someone wrote a newer version doesn't mean you have to play it. If your previous version works for you, stick with that. That's fine.
Yeah.
Doesn't change anything for you.
Yeah.
Nope.
Don't let it ruin your childhood. Trust me.
My favorite edition remains second.
And mine too, because I've worked on all the editions, but second is the one I can think in. Because I created enough of the rules for that, or I playtested enough of the rules for that, put those two together, and it's like, that's the language I think in. Right. And I mean, I have to use whatever edition we're writing for right now, and the current copyright holder has begun this thing of burning the bridges behind them, like, you can't publish old editions if you're doing new stuff, you know. So what that means is an enforced route march into each new edition. We have to use the new edition. You can't do stuff for the old. So increasingly, I'm working on the current edition, whatever it is at the time. And goodness knows, we've done lots and lots of playtests where, okay, we've got a new falling rules. Let's run it this way. Okay, let's run the same encounter with this other variant. Let's try this, because we're doing playtesting. But yeah, it's still second edition is the one I think in. And it's different for every gamer. It's the one you started with. Like I said, it's
right
when you were 12, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not second is superior. It's just the one I think in.
It's the one I started with, not the one I played the most of.
Right.
But even then, it remained, for some reason, the one that I enjoy the most. It has a distinct feel to it. That is obviously, I'm talking with, like, you know, nostalgia glasses on. Because I know that there are things that if I were to play, like, to GM a game, DM a game of second edition D&D right now, there are things that I would be like, ah, you know what? Yeah, no, we're gonna change that rule. We're gonna change that thing because, well, you know, some things weren't that great with it. I never really got into speed factors with weapons.
Weapon speed factors. Yes, the wasted page in the.
You know what? Let's just skip it altogether. Yep. But like that was a thing that, you know, just because it has it doesn't mean that it's worse. I got used to Thaco, so I can't say anything about that. Mm-hmm. I got used to it. A lot of people hated it, and I know it was a lot of math, but it's not that big of a deal. This is going to get me canceled. Yeah, no, not big of a deal for me. Like, that's the thing, but I never understood why saving throws were reversed. Like, you had to roll high on a d20 to hit, but low on a d20 to save. When they made everything higher is better with third edition onwards, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, I would do that again.
And I'm going to let you in on a little secret. In early Gen Cons, they would quite often ask me to run like a charity event or something like that. Table of D&D. And they would also quite often handicap me without intending to, because there'd be things like, oh, the mayor of Milwaukee wants to sit in on this. Or his kid does. Or his wife does, because she wants to see what the kids have been doing down in the basement. She's really suspicious. So I'd end up with somebody who'd never played before. And they knew that that would go just fine, because I didn't give a hoot about the rules. So I'd be saying, so what do you want to do? My character's going to climb through the window. I want to get around behind him and then eavesdrop. Okay. Roll me a d20. Okay, what do I need? Never mind, just roll me a d20. Yeah. Okay. Okay, you're around behind him. Okay. So I was... And you know, the gamers are going, wait a minute. You see, I'm always going to give them initiative unless it's a situation where you charge through a doorway and the guards are waiting with their bows ready for anybody coming through the doorway. You know, aside from those sort of situations, the heroes are always going to be the heroes. They're always going to get the DM's benefit of the doubt. And once people realized that, they would relax and forget about he's not following the rules, he's doing no rules. And what that meant is I could easily handle newcomers to the game. And the other thing is, it became self-policing. If we had anybody at the table who said, oh, let me show you, little lady, what you should be doing with your character.
Kick him in the nuts.
You know? Yeah. I mean, the whole table would say, hey! And the only exception to that would be when you had somebody who really was nervous and shy and say, oh, yeah, please help.
Right.
You know, the help was accepted, fine. You know, but other than that, no, you just didn't do that. And as a result of that, it doesn't matter what edition, because we're role-playing, we're storytelling. And of course, there are people who would absolutely hate that. And, you know, when I go old school stuff at Gary Con or... this year it'll be Founders and Legends as well. You know, it'll be like, yeah, I'm just gonna, we're gonna be storytelling together. What do I need to roll? Never mind. Hey, wait a minute, that means you can cheat. Yep, it does mean I can cheat. I'm the dungeon master. I can do anything. If you're worried about that, don't sit down at the table. But I want you guys to be the heroes. You guys are gonna win. This is all about you. It's not about me. It's not adversarial. Really. Just sit down and have an adventure. And that means it's really useful for newcomers, because they can just play. And they go, oh, so when do we start playing? You are playing. This is it. And of course, in the old days of the Satanic Panic, you know, they would look at me and said, but you're just sitting around talking. Yep. This is D&D. Where are the candles? We've run out of black candles in this neighborhood. And don't even start me on the virgins. You know, right. I looked everywhere. You know, so we have to do it.
Look, the cult evolved past candles. We use incandescent lights.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the electric light. Ooh, you know. So, So I mean, I don't ever want to, which is why when we get into the edition wars, I get it that gamers want to talk shop, and one of the ways you talk shop is preferring this rule over that rule or this implementation, and that's totally okay. But then when it turns into trashing gamers who play another edition, which the copyright holder has been guilty of on some occasions in the past, you know, because, oh, you shouldn't play that old crap, you know.
Here's new crap to play.
Yeah, there's new crap. Buy our new crap, yeah. It's like, really? You're going to divide the hobby over this, like, willingly, deliberately? Yeah. Holy crap. Mm-hmm. Get a life, you know, which is the polite way of putting it. I would be a lot less polite if I was, you know, in private. Do not harm our hobby. Do not set gamers at each other's throats. God knows they know how to do that by themselves. They don't need the help from you.
They don't fucking need your help. We're really good at it on our own. Thank you. I was going to say that that's part of the problem, like why I said is, you know, how my group plays is different in its own sense. Because we are partially blind to fully blind. I roll for my players. This drives a lot of players crazy. They absolutely... What do you mean you roll for them? Well, they tell me what they want to do. I roll the dice. I add everything up that's needed from their sheet, and then I tell them what happens. So one, we don't have breaks in story. It's far more immersive for them. And I don't have to worry about someone who can't see something has to wait for their reader to catch up, or, you know, like, we don't have to have the dips in our gameplay that occur because we're visually impaired. For other people, it's unnerving. Like, somehow you control the dice if it goes from your hand or mine.
But I do get the psychological thing of, I want to roll the dice because then I feel I'm doing something.
Yes.
And it's the same way that my father served in the military in an era when everybody smoked. Mm-hmm. And he was already starting to cough, and this is not a good idea. So he did what, and the moment he became an officer, he did the protective camouflage. You get a pipe, and you fiddle with it for hours. You're actually smoking very little, because you're spending your time rotting it out, tamping it down, talking, gesturing with it. And of course, the same way, rolling dice at the table gives you the feeling you're doing something.
Yes.
So I get it from that point of view. But other than that, why not let the Dungeon Master, if they're going to take that off your hands, great.
Yeah, and when you have a bunch of players that, you know, we all need different things in order to compensate for, well, I ain't saying it that way because it does imply like we need tools beyond what a normal sighted person uses. We don't. You know, we can still use D&D Beyond, but there's some accessibility things that aren't as easy. And it's just as easy for me to do it than it is them. But also, we love the story aspect of it more than we care about whether or not we specifically made, you know, rolled a 20 or not. Like, we understand the thrill of it, but we're all theater kids. We are here 100% for the story. And in the middle of combat, you're not just going to just start yelling, woohoo, because you rolled a nat 20. They don't want that. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They want that immersive experience of, like, they landed something and did something really cool. Or as they roll something, they don't ever know what they actually roll. Like, we have a log of what rolls were what in case they ever want to look. But for the most part, they don't. They just find it hilarious when they're like, yeah, I want to do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, okay, well, you start to do X, but then Y cuts in your way and Z lands on the ground, you know? Like, needless to say, they figure out that they've rolled a one, you know, without us having to say it and without that, like, moment of disappointment before they hear what happens. So they love that aspect of it. So, but when I go to play for other people who do want to roll dice and not have that same kind of experience, it's really hard for me to get out of that. And I was like, all right, that's why for the game that I was playing with Simon, I wanted, like, I need sighted players who want to roll dice so I could get used to this, so I could one day actually DM for a group other than just mine.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't happen. Things fell apart.
At some point, don't worry.
I know.
But it will happen.
Oh, that is a bane. I mean, scheduling is...
Yep.
I think the greatest monster.
Well, I think it's also because most of my friends are other creatives. Mm-hmm. And when do we have time compared to other people?
Yes, true.
So, yeah, especially when it's like, it's not a big deal to technically be off the clock and still work because, you know, we kind of love what we do so much that it doesn't really bother us to spend quote-unquote free time doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plus, you know, especially if we, you know, somebody has like a 9-to-5 job and they do a lot of freelancing in the evenings or weekends, all that time's eaten up, can't play the game, fucking sucks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. This is why we get together every once in a great while, although I love my players because they continue to play without me. They're fantastic. We have a text-based role-playing chat that they just keep having inter-character interactions with. So it's great. They get a lot of team-building time that normally I don't get at other tables. So I'm super happy.
Mm.
Yeah.
That sounds cool. That's yeah. Great when your players do that. It's
Oh yeah, they're a bunch of fucking thespians. They're listening. I've already been informed that they're listening.
You say that as if it's a bad thing. The thespians, not the listening.
No, I just like to tease them about it because there is a mammoth thread. One of these days, I'm gonna put the world that we play in fully on Legend Keeper, just to show how much note taking goes on in conversation between my players. Because they have huge dialogue. So, you know, we play our in-game sessions are, you know, whatever expanse of time, you know, that happens to be for the story. They will take little brackets and put them in our text chat. And then that means that they're going to have a side conversation at some other point in time because they don't want to slow down the flow of what we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And they will always go back and just fill in hours like their two characters were just sitting around in a pub throwing back tankards and just sharing everything. But by the time that we get to the next session, it is like two people who have sat down and done that. So time-wise, it works a lot better for them actually being a group instead of the... I don't actually have a reason to stay in life-threatening situations with a bunch of strangers.
Yes.
That we just kind of like, you know, suspension of disbelief type of thing. But yeah, so they figured out a way to work that out without me, which is awesome.
That sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah, so I love to tease them that they're a bunch of thespian actors. Getting really into their roles. Every time we start, I tell them their motivation. You want to not get killed by a dragon.
Yeah, survival. That's what it always comes down to. Survival.
Yeah, although right now we're having a non-combat-ish campaign.
Ish. I love the way you said that. Ish.
Well, because we did have combat in towards the beginning of it, and then, like normal, but one of the characters suffered a traumatic experience and didn't want to go into combat and almost didn't want to be a part of the group, and the player considered rolling a new character. So instead, the other characters said, well, then, you know, we are going to approach things differently because we're, you know, they all had this moment of like, oh shit, we're giving ourselves PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
How do we avoid that? How do we, you know, not die young as adventurers? And so we are trying a more diplomatic route. We have a little sign on our during our sessions that says how many days we've gone without combat. Yeah. I don't remember what we're up to, but I know that we've made it past 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah. So, which is, you know, pretty good for them considering what they've done in the past.
And it also means that they are not training themselves to be murder hobos in real life.
Oh, yeah.
But actually to deal with the real world on a slightly less lethal basis.
Yes. Yes. The only thing is that it does make certain things for me a little bit more prep work-wise, because I have to work on... I do work out specific puzzles or... things that give them a non-combat route,
yes.
Then, you know, normally it's just like planning a bunch of monsters and stuff. So, you know, that's been fun.
Yeah, I've had a character that I started playing once because speaking of combat and PTSD, and it's a theme that I want to approach again. We'll take D&D as an example, but it works with pretty much any role-playing game out there. You get into your first fight, and you're going to absolutely murder whatever it is in front of you. What does that do to a person?
Right.
Like, have you ever, if you've never done it before, what makes you want to do it? Like, what's going to push you over the edge? But also, how are you going to feel afterwards? Like, I made a truly first, well, I say truly first level character. Basically, the person, you know, just went out of their... left their parents' farm, had actually never killed even an animal before. So it was a wheat farm. And while they did have like beasts of burdens and all that, he never had to put down any of them. I wanted him to be as sheltered as possible and then to say, okay, first time you meet goblins and you have to kill a goblin. What's going to happen to you?
Right.
What is... Because it's something that especially in D&D, it feels like it is normal. Like, you get into your first fight, it's, you know, kill or be killed. But we rarely think about what's going to happen after that. Like, what are the changes psychologically that come in with this all? And of course, this requires almost an entire, like, the approval of the rest of the players, because it's going to shape how the group, or at least how that character is going to approach the rest of the game afterwards.
Oh, yeah. There's a system out called the Midnight World, which Devin and Dustin from D4 are now using for the Velvet Lodge game that they're playing, that absolutely intrigues me. And I want to play a game of this so bad. It is with emotional consequences. You have a ticking clock that every time something happens, you can either comfort yourself or something happens that takes minutes, so to speak, off your clock. And the closer you get to midnight, the more maddening it gets. I'm absolutely interested in playing a game of this and seeing how it goes. It looks amazing.
Yeah, I like games where you slowly spiral into losing your mind little by little.
Just like real life, no.
I mean, it feels like it.
Well, the brain is an interesting thing. I want to see what happens when it breaks.
That did not in any way, shape, or form sound terrifying.
Okay, I'm not going to do it to anyone IRL. That's why I'm doing it through role-playing games in other, like, perfectly safe environments. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
He said hastily. Yeah.
Yes. Just a little too quickly.
I need to clarify before my FBI agent, you know, overhears it and sends someone over.
Right.
Yes, realms, people in the realms, relationship to gods versus the multiverse.
Uh-huh.
Like, when you start thinking about, and it, this is from my, like, my point of view, my theory, right? You live in a world where you know that depending on, again, you said, you know, you think in second edition. So I think in time of troubles, it's pretty much my default, like, a year for the realms. So you know that the gods in one way or another, like, you know that they exist. You know that there are things that are greater, more powerful, and completely utterly alien to how you live. Like, what does that do to the reality of most people? Because I know that most of, like, let's say peasants, like, they have other shit to worry about. Like, you have your harvest to worry about, you have your shop to run, you have your daily life that might probably take up 100% of your time, so you don't have to think about that. But for those people who actually have the free time to think about it, like, how does it change a person, for instance, to know that you know where you're going to go once you die? Or is this so obscured within the fiction of the game that even though we as players reading the encyclopedia, you know, the campaign setting, we know that you go to the fugue plane, you get judged by Kelimvor and all that. But, like, how would it change? Does it change people? Or do they, and I think that would be my question to Ed, is do people actually know that? Or if I shout that in the streets of Waterdeep, I'm going to get sent to the loony bin?
No, you're not going to get sent to the loony bin. That's the short answer. Here's the All Father of the Realms doing his thing. The game gave us, so this was a given for me going in. The game gave us fallible gods, super humans, as in they're just as bad as humans. They're just super powered. That was like the Greek gods, like the Roman gods.
Yeah.
And that's also necessary from my point of view psychologically for the realm setting before D&D, because otherwise nobody has any agency. There are no heroes because everything's predestined. No, I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way, sort of thing. You know, you have no culpability because you're just following a script, which is why you have to be very careful in fiction about, you know, a destiny and prophecies, one ring to rule them all. You know, okay, it has to be, if you don't screw this up, or competing prophecies as the Eddingses did in Belgariad and Melorion, you know, the child of light and the child of darkness, and in some versions this, and in some versions that, we have to actually do it to see who wins, sort of thing. So we know that the gods are fallible, and we know that everybody, priesthoods included, lie to us. Propaganda. They're making their deity seem more important or at the center of things or key, so that we will give more offerings. Because everybody believes in all the gods. There's no, it's not like in our real world where faith, you have to take on faith and it's the strength of your faith. And Christians in particular will prattle on endlessly about faith. No, in the realms, everybody knows the gods are real. They see it, they feel it, they hear it. They don't have to take anything on faith. What they have to take on faith is not the gods, it's the priesthoods, what they're being told about the gods. Because these priesthoods are, and I realize I'm generalizing here, human. Yeah. Partially human. And humans lie. They lie like rugs. They lie all the time to get what they want out of you. And in the case of the clergy in the realms, it's to get you to do their bidding and, by the way, put some money in the plate because I don't want to have to work for a living. And that means everybody. All we know about the realms. You know, Elminster could be lying to us all this time, as he could be feeding us Mistra propaganda. So
he would never do that to me.
Well, probably not. And the way I've written him, no. He will tell lies, but they'll be little white lies for your own good. Ha ha. But that's the thing. Everybody believes in all the gods, and they, most of the worship is to hold something at bay. You know, I have to get on a ship for the first time in my life. I'm going to die. I'm going to drown at sea. So I'm going to make offerings to Umberlee. Please don't sink the ship. Because I have to, you know, get on it. And if I'm a farmer, okay, I'm making my offerings to Shanti. I'm probably copulating in the furrows, too, just to make sure that that field produces well. No, I'm hedging my bets, because I also know that the gods fight again with each other. They contest constantly. So there got to be winners and losers. So this means, okay, I still have to do it for myself. So the average person, the peasant who's scratching for a living, in the end, we got to do it for ourselves. But we do believe in the gods. We don't necessarily believe on what my fate is at death, because priests told me that, and the priests lie like rugs. They want my offerings, they want me to be scared of them, they want me to obey them, so they could be selling me a bill of goods. I won't know what happens till I get to death, and it stared me in the eyes. And guess what? Often, when deities manifest, meaning they appear to mortals, you will say the same thing. Wait until it happens. You'll see the truth then. Because they want to hold everybody, like, to curb the bad behavior. Unless someone is their special agent, you know, like, chosen or whatever. I'm gonna send you to do this for me, and I want you to know and be cured. They want the seed of doubt there, because that makes all these mortals malleable. And all of these deities are in competition with each other for worshippers, and that determines their overall power. That is how I give and keep the agency with the players, and the player characters being the heroes who can change the world. Deities have to be that way. That's the only sane and fair way to run them. And as a result, you don't know for sure what's going to happen to you. You know what the priests have told you. But guess what? The priests down the road of that other god, and everybody believes in all the gods. And this is the one thing that many modern gamers, particularly if they were raised in a monotheistic tradition like Christianity, they have a hard time wrapping their heads around. It's easier if they came from, say, Hinduism and, you know, polytheistic. But I used to get this all the time from the TSR designers back in the day when they were first rolling out the realms. And they'd say, okay, so which god is my god? And I said, all the gods are your gods. Yeah, yes, but which one is mine? I'd say, are you playing a cleric or a paladin? You'd say, no. Then all of the gods. No, but which one is mine? Because they couldn't get away from the real world thought teachings that have been rammed down their throats since they were little kids. But it's like, no, all of the gods. You know all the gods are real. They appear to you. And if they don't appear to you, they appear in your dream visions. They speak to you personally. That's how the gods get you to do something. That's how you peasant in the corner, that's how you are important. God spoke to me in my dream. God appeared to me because I matter. Everyone matters. And as a result, you're not traumatized by knowing this is what's going to happen to me when I die. No, this is what the priests told me. Those priests, they lie like rugs. They're human, like all the rest of us. They lie like rugs. So, that's what they told me, but the god might have told me something different. You never know. And that's the way I've run it from the word go, because it makes all the stuff you do at the table matter, instead of, oh, it's all a script. Doesn't matter what you try and do. Gods will decide. It has to be that way for the game. That's baked into the game. So from the beginning, I have run it that way. And some people don't get that, and they go, but you're just semantics. No, not just semantics. That's the way it has to be. That was sort of, when I agreed to make this a D&D setting for myself, I'm accepting that. I have to accept that. That's a logic puzzle of D&D. That's built into the game. And so when it becomes a published setting, that comes with it. It has to be that way. Otherwise, everything is for naught. We're all just following a script, and it doesn't matter. Do whatever the hell you want with your player characters, because it's not being determined by you. It's being determined by the gods. And that would be the truly scary thing.
Priests lying being where things are actually, or not necessarily lying, but even their interpretation because of their church and what they want due to just their like mundane needs. Oh, you give me more money, I'm going to make sure you step, you know, in front of the line in the City of Judgment. Like, that's never going to happen. But the priest says that to the noble. The noble forks out more money. Priest doesn't need to beg for it.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily mean that all clergy are dishonest, twisted. They may believe the line they're peddling because the god told them that. Or a servitor of the god, you know, a quote, immortal, an angel, or if you will, or, you know, they may believe the line they're peddling. That's the best sort of liars, the people who really believe what they're saying. You know, and it may not be deliberate deception. And the priest may be very fervent about it. Oh, no, the god showed me. The god told me. No, you must believe me. No. Because I'm not saying that all clergy are lying, cheating, stealing. No, that was like, and I'm saying many of them are mistaken or have been deceived by their deities, or they are putting the best interpretation on something that their mind can't grasp because they're mortal. They're making their best guidance because they too want to do the right thing in life. They're trying to guide themselves as well as you. But in the end, it has to be that you still have agency as a character in the world. So therefore, the gods have to be fallible, and so on and so forth, and things of that nature. Yeah.
Because one of the things that always interests me in world building and storytelling is always about. I always start with the religious angle, because I feel like it was for us humans the very first type of stories that we would tell. Like, it started with this. In my mind, the first storytellers, you know, became eventually the priesthoods of those, you know, proto-deities that eventually evolved to become like the Greek pantheon in Greece and in other religions elsewhere. So I'm always like interesting, and I want to know everything about like gods and religion and the aspects thereof. So I have a lot of questions. I have like two favorite deities in the Forgotten Realms. And there's one of them that I want to know about, but it's Illustrae.
Yes.
I think I read somewhere that Illustrae was like added after the fact. So if she was, how do you like retrofit these things?
Ah, okay.
And also, was she added just for the purpose of having a redeeming figure?
I believe so, to answer that last one. When I was doing Drow of the Underdark, and TSR and now WotC make our lives hell by reusing titles over and over again for different products. Mm. So this is the original Drow of the Underdark, one with the black cover, like with spiderweb stuff on it. Okay. Second edition. Okay. I was tasked there by the editrix with adding a good deity, and she was getting the word from on high that we needed to have a good deity of the drow. So Illustrae actually existed in my own realms before D&D. Okay. She was added to the published realms at that time, because initially hadn't been in there, because everything had to match the game when the realms was first purchased and started as an official setting. So the Dark Dancer was around from the beginning. The drow are Gary Gygax's version of the Zvart Elfar, or the Dark Elfar. The in Norse mythology, the two of them are so interchangeably mentioned, and that, okay, is it the Dark Elfar or the Zvart Elfar? It doesn't matter, because they're pretty much, you know, those evil type critters down in the world below. And even the way they look and how can be different. They can be like dwarves, you know, in some tellings.
Yeah, in some tales they're actually dwarves.
Yeah. So, but D&D version of them comes from what we saw in the Descent into the Depths of the Earth modules way back when. It's not way back when for me. I remember playing in those at Gen Cons when they were being trotted out. But anyway, yes, I'm older than dirt. The idea was to give people who were role-playing Drow as characters but didn't want to be evil. And part of that was thought amongst the designers of the game at the time that they didn't want people who would deliberately backstab other gamers and break up gaming groups and say, but that's what my character's alignment would have them do. You know, so mm-hmm. they wanted to have an outlet for people who wanted to play Drow but be of good alignment. So they wanted to have a deity they could stand for. I gave them my existing deity, which is where you got the nude lady dancing, which they were not pleased with, but they were not pleased with after the fact, because the editorial staff working on that particular book, who happened to be pagans in real life, said, oh, cool, I can dance around the fire. You've given us thank you, Ed. And then of course, the higher-ups who were, you know, Christian through and through, but not caring. I mean, well, I would call commercial Christian, meaning, don't do anything that will cost us sales. That's how devout we are. No.
Yep.
Yeah. It went, oh my God, Ed and his naked woman again. No. And it's like, where did you all come from? I hope she was naked, because that's a lot of clothing ruined if she wasn't. Right. You know, but leaving all that aside, we were retconning, putting in deity, and I did the magician's trick in that product, Drow the Underdark. I also took the unnamed Elder Elemental God from Greyhawk, which I've been told had to go in the Realms because Realms was now the official setting, so it had to encompass everything. I said, there's no effing way I'm putting a deity in the Realms that doesn't have a name. People can't pray to. So I, Gonadar name, you know, arrived at that point. So, but I did that undercover. Oh, don't look at my left hand, look at my right hand. I could be a magician in the same product to, take care of that little design thing that I had to take care of. And the whole point of Illustri, which Bob wasn't thrilled with, Bob Salvatore, because it's like, hey, you're messing with the Drow. Drow are mine. And of course, that's when I had to say to Bob, you know, how many times has the company told you? Drow are everybody's. Every gamer at every table. And he goes, yeah, but you know what I mean. And I said, yeah, I do know what you mean. But in this case, they told me to do it. And he says, well, not in my effing realms. And I said, that's fine. Not at your table, but we're going to write about them this way. And of course, there were others who felt the same way, which is why, you know, if we can kill her off, or if we can kill off, you know, the other, you know, Varon and all this, first chance we get, we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. Fine. That is something that happens in the world. That's part of the history of the world. That is something else that makes the world seem more real. So I'm for it. I'm not for going back to the well once too often. And that is the, oh, we have a new edition of D&D. Mr. has to die again.
How often? Well, that's how I count editions in Forgotten Realms. How many times has Mr. died?
I have nothing against deities dying, because it establishes something else that happened in the world. I am against it being overused like anything else is overused, because it bespeaks a looking down on the setting from above, like a person who's built a model railroad layout but the table's too low because they want to save their back, so they're always looking down on their own created world. they start to get that viewpoint that they are God and they look down on it. And I want them to think of it from the viewpoint of somebody living in the setting. It's really traumatic when gods die all the time. It is major. It's like your COVID pandemic. It's like your world wars. It changes everything. There is before and there is after. So if we could cut down on the killing deities, particularly the killing deities, just to make a dramatic chapter ending in a book, I would really appreciate it if you guys would come up with some other storytelling mechanism. You know, like spending 5 minutes thinking something through rather than going for the cheap thrill.
I know which book you're talking about. I have it.
Yeah, but I mean, they're all like that. It's like, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. No, it's like, can you guys not come up with any other storytelling trope? God damn it. And I feel that way because it's like, no, you are in effect disrespecting the setting because you're going to cause trauma to a lot of home campaigns. A lot of dungeon masters have set up plots and so on. And you just walked all over them for, as far as I can tell, no good reason. Or, well, because I could finish my working day early and go home. That's the thing. If we're doing it for story reasons, it should be long-lasting, well-thought-out story reasons. Not, oh, this is a cheap plot hook. This gets me into the next edition. And it's something really important, a la... And of course, again, Marvel Comics rears its head again. It was every 50 issues in Thor, we have Ragnarok. Every 50 issues. So everybody has to buy issue 50 or issue 100 or issue 150 because a god will die! Ragnarok. You know, you have to have this if you are a fan of the comic because something important has happened. Anyway, that's there you go. Very long-winded answer, but there you go.
Oh, that's what this podcast is for, long-winded answers.
Oh, good. Okay, well, I'm good at that. Yeah.
I'll just cut this into several parts. So I have a question for you. Have you seen Baldur's Gate 3 video game?
Little bits and pieces of it. I have been shown it by various things from it, usually stills or moments from it, by various gamers saying, hey, what's this? Or, hey, what would Elminster really do and say here? Or, you know, that it's like, no, yeah. Please don't. Come on. You know. But, yeah, I haven't had a chance to play it because no time. In the old days, problem always was I had a Mac and all the computer games were built and designed on Macs or Sun Spark micro stations because the IBM PCs of the day just couldn't handle them. But they were all designed for IBM PCs, so you couldn't play them on your home computer if you had a Mac. And why did I have a Mac? Because that's what TSR sent me as my advance for writing Spellfire because they wanted me to write on computers instead of typing up for their secretarial pool. So instead of paying me money for Spellfire, they sent me a computer a year after the book was due. And the printer arrived, the image writer arrived broken. It wasn't their fault, the shipping. But yeah.
So do you intend to play? If you ever have a chance?
Okay. Oh, yeah. I intend to play. This accounts for all the uptick in Baldur's Gate lore that gamers have been asking about ever since I did Murder in Baldur's Gate. And, of course, now, knowing that John Shindahedi, the art director of Wizards at the time, is now the art director at Larian, makes me wonder how much of it was like, let's ask Ed, but let's not tell Ed we're asking him. Let's just ask Ed with a lore answer, and he'll give another lore answer. And I don't mind. That's fun. I love doing this. But yeah, I'm now intrigued to see how close I got some things and how much. Because for storytelling purposes, when doing a deeply immersive narrative computer game, you have to invent things. You have to. You're inventing your own story. And I don't mind if people invent things. That's what you do with the realms. What I mind is if it doesn't feel right, if it's so far divorced from feeling of the realms that I'm thinking to myself, nah, they got it wrong. And of course, I'm always going to keep that to myself, because for somebody else, it isn't wrong. It's right. It's their experience of the realms. And it's not up to me, because there's the difference between my home realms and the published realms. And it's incredibly arrogant of me to say, oh, no, that isn't the right realms. And, but to me, I want to know if it feels like the realms. So, yeah, I will be playing it to see, okay, how much does it feel like the realms? And as it happens, in my household right now, I have a whole bunch of boarders, and they all work with computers one way or the other, as in moderators of community groups, or tech support, or dyed-in-the-wool gamers who play. So they're all glued to their computers right now playing it. This household has been silent as a tomb since I got back from Gen Con, because they come out, they scuttle out like trolls just to get food, and then they scuttle back in again. So they're playing the game, and I fully intend, if I can ever snatch the time, because before Gen Con there was a flurry of, could you just do this for us and bring it to Gen Con? Sure. Now that I'm home from Gen Con, there's a flurry of, hey, now that we've done Gen Con, we know what we need, this, this, and this. Could you please just, yeah, no problem. But if I ever get the time free, I will be wanting to play a bit of a walkthrough to at least see the sights around Baldur's Gate, and hopefully really get into it. Because I want to know that it has the feel of the realms. They captured it right, and that's what matters the most to me, that they captured it right. It's not that they make little, like the D&D movie, it's not like they make little changes here and there to weld shape or something, or it's does it feel like the realms to me when I'm watching the movie? And if the answer is yes, then they won, they succeeded. That's what I want. I've already had umpteen questions about, hey Ed, is that really what tiefling dicks look like? Or something of the sort?
Dragonborn, yeah.
I didn't even look. You know, oddly enough,
I have seen things.
Yeah, both Simon and I are obsessing over the game.
Uh-huh.
I'm only 300 hours in. Since the early access, by the way, in the last, 3 years combined.
Oh, okay, I was going to say, since it came out, get some sleep, man.
No,
right? I mean,
since it came out, it's only been 50. I took two whole days off of work just to play, because I've been waiting for this for since Baldur's Gate 2 came out years ago.
Yeah. What character are you going to play, Ed?
I don't know yet. Now, being as they won't let me play Elminster as a player character, I'm just kidding.
There's things I want to say, but I'm not going to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't
I can't
spoil
say anything.
Anything either, Simon.
No, it's all right. I've already been shown a lot of the stuff. One of the things I always used to do during the playtests, in the past, and we're going back Neverwinter Nights and way back into the early SSI games. One of the things I used to always do is play a female player character, A to C. That was baked into the game, if you got the chance to do that, and B, to see how badly the female character would be treated by the game designers. Because I was all about, no, I want more women in the hobby. I want you guys to stop being creeps when you deal with women, because I don't want any more discouragement of women at the gaming table. God's sake, can you guys, keep your dicks in the, for 5 minutes and give us a decent game? So I always wanted to see how they got treated. And the other times I was playing it as part of what we would now call a friends and family playtest. Being given early access to games and asked to play this scene or play that cutscene. And here's a cheat that will get you alive through the game so you can fast forward to here, because this is the bit we want to play, want you to play and play through. And that tends to color your enjoyment of the game. You can postpone playing the game for fun, because you've sort of sampled it, but you sampled it on this sort of horrible basis of, we want you to do this, we We want you to play this scene over and over. We want you to, you know, do this stupid thing that you would never do in real life to see if it breaks what we programmed here, you know. And there were early games.
Mm.
This happened more in the early games, days of the computer gaming industry, because it was very easy to overload capacities of the computers at the time. Just to give you an example, Wolfenstein, Castle Wolfenstein, which, you know, was given out as a free disc to get you to play in the early days. If you went high enough levels and you kept on creating guard dogs and so on, eventually they became invisible because the game's engine couldn't render them fast enough. So you were fighting invisible dogs. They hadn't intended to be in the game programmers hadn't intended to be invisible. They just limitations of the engine. Anyway, stuff like that. And I'm somewhat hampered in what I can say on this subject because there are NDAs. So there's some things I can't say about everything. But yeah, I'm most intrigued to play, and I will probably have loads of fun doing it. But problem with computer games, they consume gobs of time. Play them and really enjoy them.
Yeah.
What's the one thing I've haven't had enough of for the last 50 odd years of my life? Gobs of time. And as I get older, my mortality rushes up and becomes more and more apparent to me. Like it's dangled in front of my eyes, and it's like, yeah, I mustn't go down that rabbit hole. Or I really want to, but I mustn't. I absolutely mustn't, because I got to get this done, or I got to get that done, or these people are waiting for me to do that. And that's a powerful incentive. These people are waiting for this. You know, I don't want to be the bottleneck, because, you know, when it comes right down to it, I watched as a gamer, as a young gamer, Gary Gygax unwillingly be the bottleneck for D&D because he was trying to run the company and he had a tiger by the tail. The company was expanding by leaps and bounds. He wanted to design a bigger and better game system. And he was working hard on that. And at the same time, he wanted to bring into print stuff from Greyhawk, from his home campaign, Castle Greyhawk. We were waiting and waiting and waiting because one guy can't do it all. He was trying to do three things at once and something had to give. So we waited and we waited. And if you're old enough as a gamer, you'll remember issue 21 of Dragon combined with Little Wars, in which you got an apology for the Dungeon Master's guide taking so long. And here are just the tables, combat tables from Dungeon Master's Guide, because we know that you Dungeon Masters are waiting and waiting out there, so here are the tables so you can play your games, because the book won't be ready until later this year. No, and I've been acutely aware of that for all these years. I mustn't be the bottleneck. Now, of course, TSR took care of that at the beginning of the realm, so I'm making sure that I wasn't writing all the novels, you know, and I wouldn't be the bottleneck. And I would have loved to have written more novels, but at the same time, they were saying, Ed, you got to show us the world. You got to roll out the world. We need all this real estate. We need to see the planet. So, and I was happily doing that and holding down a full-time job. And my wife and I were commuting 100 miles each way every day for that full-time job. So I get time and bottlenecks, and that's why I have to resist each computer game. I have to resist. But I mean, I just have to turn my back on it and say, no, I must be strong. So many people are depending on me. I must be strong. And leave it for now. I don't want to.
I'm weak. That's why I...
Oh, yeah, me
but
too.
You guys are... it's meant for you guys. You don't have to wait.
Yeah, but we both have obligations that we're sort of putting off. Just to play the game.
I get that.
Because, you know, yeah... This all started because I'm a gamer and a huge Elder Scrolls fan, and because I mean, although I made maps for my D&D games previously, I made a map of Skyrim because I wanted an in-world map. I wanted something that looked like it came from the game, and shared it online, and then everyone just sort of like, oh my god, can you make maps for me? And that's how this whole fantasy cartographer career started. So I kind of, not that I write off the time that I'm gaming as like research, but kinda. You know, I try and work it into my, like, I purposefully didn't schedule work around the release of this game because I knew I'd be playing it too much. So that was really hard to do because, you know, I have bills.
In one of our episodes earlier, where we were talking about all the classes of D&D and listing like some of the abilities that they have that could be construed as euphemism. But here's a slight, it's not even a curveball question. If you were to stick to the classes of D&D, which one makes the best lover?
That has to be an it depends answer. Because it depends on the lover of whom and what they're looking for. If when you make love, your object is to pleasure your partner, not get your own rocks off as fast as possible, then you're probably, or as slowly as possible, if that's what you prefer, you know, tantric sex, let's make this last for 3 days, then presumably it's what your partner most wants that would matter. I would tend to say that, and we're dealing in stereotypes here, of course, there'd be two.
There'd be course, yeah.
Thief or any, or rogue or whatever you want to call it, who uses manual dexterity and deftness in manual dexterity on a daily basis in life. And anyone who experiments with spells, doing creative experiments to try and come up with new spells because of the precision required in the castings to avoid killing yourself right up front. So I would, but again, these are a multi-class thief mage.
So a multi-class
multi-class thief mage trips over their own equipment. Boy, I'm being delicate here.
My goodness.
Again, yeah. It depends. And of course, like everything else in life, it depends upon the personality of the individual involved. We all know wizards who are prince wins, you know, and we all know wizards who are highly competent, and we all know wizards who are charlatans, mountebanks, or whose self-description of their competency outstrips their real competency by a long shot.
The question should actually be, what do you prefer? What would be your dream lover there, Ed?
Oh, well, I had my dream lover.
Right.
And she's dead. I outlived her because she's 25 years older than me. So, you know.
Right.
But okay, to
in the game though.
In the game.
In the
yes.
game.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Okay. My
thanks
dream
for making
lover,
me feel bad, Ed.
it's okay. I didn't mean to, I would say my dream lover would be someone who first and foremost could be my friend. And my trusted companion, because I have outgrown my teenage passion, wild passion. Oh, look at that, hot! You know, and instead, I want a companion that I can count on in life. That's right. And who will be by my side and have my back and all those cliche terms. But you know, that's what I'm looking for. And therefore, my dream lover would be somebody in the setting whom I could trust like that. If it was just who's hot, I think I would go for Storm Silverhand. Just right. Because of she's been den mother to so many Harpers. She's trained them. She is by nature sensitive to the needs of others and to what others need themselves psychologically at this moment in their lives. So she is going to be the most wonderful lover because her heart is in the right place and she's doing everything for whoever she's making love with, not for her. And because I would be overawed by such a person, I would want the most to give her pleasure. So I would be, not that there would be no pressure or anything like that, but I mean, that's what I'd be trying for. And that's what I'd be most pleased and proud of if I could pull it off. As a man of my age, I'd put my tanned athletic 1.5 inches at her disposal. I'm not the man I used to be. to quote Scrooge, I'm not the man I used to be.
I mean, okay.
Hey, I. Like,
no, we asked the like question. We said it's our fault.
Yeah, like we said at the beginning, I have no secrets. I evidently, obviously, have no filters either. But okay with that.
No, that's good. That's good.
But yeah, to me, it's the whole realms is about love. I don't necessarily mean sexual love. I mean, whole realms is love of life, love of the world, love of all the characters in it, love of just what it is like to live in this world as a human and get to see various versions of all of these people at their good and bad. So we get to see our heroes and our villains do their thing. And to me, it is the whole thing of the act of creation is an act of love. Because let's face it, there are other ways you could earn your shekels and the creative things that we do. And so I think that a creative life is a life of love. You're sharing your love of the world and your love of people you hope will enjoy what you're producing.